Welcome to the Weekly Digest from Personalized Intelligence, this technology edition for Monday, June 29th, 2026.
Today's focus is on the accelerating erosion of traditional technical barriers, where the bottleneck is shifting from human coding proficiency to the availability of raw computational power. We are moving from an era of manual logic construction to one defined by high-level intent and automated execution.
Essentially, the barrier to entry is collapsing, but the cost of staying in the game is skyrocketing.
Something to flag here, we need to examine how this structural shift redefines the very nature of software architecture.
We begin by analyzing the rise of vibe coding and what it means for the future of engineering. Andrew Ambrosino at OpenAI is essentially telling us that the days of engineers hunched over a keyboard, manually wrestling with semicolons and syntax, are effectively dead. Today we're looking at the rise of vibe coding, a world where software is built not by writing instructions, but by steering a fleet of autonomous agents through a fog of high-level intent. It's a future where your job title shifts from software engineer to agent orchestrator, where your primary way to break a system is by being too vague, and where a single misplaced vibe results in a production outage caused by a hallucinated API endpoint.
It's a fundamental shift in the engineering frontier. As Ambrosino notes, we are moving from supervised code generation to unsupervised autonomous development. The mechanism is a transition from manual syntax construction to the orchestration of complex autonomous loops. This means the developer's task is no longer about the how of the code, but the what of the architecture, where the new skill is teaching models to recognize which features to ignore or reframe during the development cycle.
So instead of being a builder, you're essentially a middle manager for a group of very fast, very literal-minded interns who don't know when to stop working.
That's exactly what the leadership at AWS is suggesting. They see the role evolving from authoring syntax to product orchestration. The idea is that the engineer manages multiple agents throughout the entire software development lifecycle, overseeing architectural decisions rather than typing out the logic itself. Kevin Weil at OpenAI takes this a step and argues that tools like Codex are actually democratizing technical implementation. By removing the traditional programming barriers, you allow high-agency individuals to manage multiple simultaneous work trees, effectively performing several jobs at once by delegating long-duration tasks to AI agents.
It sounds incredibly efficient, right up until the moment your parallelized labor model creates a digital landfill of unreadable, unmaintainable junk.
That is the primary risk. Corey Quinn has been very vocal about the influx of what he calls AI slop, code that is generated with ease but lacks any deep understanding of large-scale infrastructure. This vibe coding era of SaaS creates a massive long-term maintenance debt. You can use an LLM to rapidly prototype a complex service in 3 days, but if that process introduces a structural bug like a memory leak that requires deep-scale expertise to debug, you've just built a technical debt bomb.
It's the classic developer trap. You get the shiny new feature today, but you're handing a massive, unfixable bill to the person who has to run it in 6 months.
And that's where the economic unit of value is actually changing. Lenny's podcast noted that the fundamental economic driver of software development has inverted. Implementation is no longer the primary cost driver. Because the cost of tokens is decreasing and the ability to prompt for solutions is becoming commoditized, the strategic value of a product team is shifting from execution to taste and curation. The primary skill is now the ability to distinguish high-signal intelligence from slop in an environment of infinite low-cost content.
So taste is the new logic. If you can't tell a good architecture from a bad one, you're just a person throwing expensive prompts at a wall to see what sticks.
We can trace that further. We're seeing a role collapse in technical organizations. As Lenny's podcast argued, the definition of a professional is shifting from a set of bounded expertise to the mathematical average of their time allocation across disciplines. You aren't just a back-end engineer, you are a designer, a tester, and an orchestrator. This even extends to the very definition of what code is. It's becoming less about syntax production and more about vocabulary building. By using higher-level programming languages to create structured names, classes, and APIs, developers are constructing a ubiquitous language that represents the business domain. This code acts as a functional harness or a structured context that steers the LLMs toward predictable implementations.
I love the idea of coding as vocabulary building. It makes it sound much more dignified than writing prompts and praying the indentation is correct.
But there is a massive complexity tax involved. As noted in Lenny's podcast, models are currently excellent at additive feature generation, but they lack the capability to perform essential garbage collection or code deletion. They can keep adding layers to the cake, but they don't know how to prune the tree. This is why the engineering depth is shifting toward a pattern seen in professional engineering, moving from depth-first exploration to business utility. Developers are increasingly managing codebases they did not personally produce and do not fully understand.
It's essentially the move fast and break things mantra, but now the breaking is automated and the moving is happening at light speed.
It's also creating entirely new markets. we're seeing the rise of economically unviable niche solutions. If you can use an AI agent to build a highly specific tool, like a Python-based system to cross-reference eBay listings with a personal Plex library, to serve a market of only 50 people, the cost of development has dropped enough to make that profitable. The engineering effort is no longer the bottleneck, it's the agency of the person with the idea.
It's great for the hobbyists, but if we're building the backbone of global infrastructure through vibes, we might eventually find that the vibe is just a total system collapse.
That's why the high-value skill is moving toward the ability to defend technical choices. As we saw in the Neat Code discussions, even when costs drop, like one developer reducing infrastructure costs from $3,000 to $200, the risk of feature bloat and technical debt remains. The extinction of programmers isn't happening because the volume of software is actually increasing, much like how cloud computing didn't kill coding, it just changed the scale. The real challenge is managing the sheer mass of the code being generated.
Software architects need to start prioritizing rigorous verification over rapid prototyping if they want to avoid a complete structural breakdown.
The focus has to shift to that high-level verification and the ability to act as a force multiplier.
Watch for the emergence of artifact testing as a standard practice, where teams intentionally release incomplete features to serve as benchmarks for future model upgrades.
The way we think about personal tech is about to get much more intimate as these agents start learning our specific preferences and habits.
There is a massive tension building in the tech sector between the efficiency crowd, the people who want AI to just summarize my emails so I can ignore them faster, and the agent crowd who want AI to actually live my life for me. If you had to bet, Alex, are we heading toward a world of smarter spreadsheets or a world of digital clones?
I'm betting on the clones, or at least the high-level orchestrators. We are moving past the era of the blank cursor, where you have to sit there and prompt a chatbot like a middle manager giving instructions. The new frontier is what Josh Ellman calls personal intelligence. It's a shift from high-agency tools that wait for you to proactive systems that leverage your private context, your calendars, your messages, your entire digital footprint to push suggestions to you.
Personal intelligence. That is a lovely euphemism for a digital stalker with a calendar invite.
It's more about agency than surveillance. Think of it as a transition from user experience, or UX, to what some are calling agentic experience, or AX. In the old model, designers focused on visual buttons for humans to click. In the AX model, the user is often another AI. Success for a designer now means creating functional affordances like optimized robots, TXT, or specialized command line instructions so that an agent can navigate a service without a human ever seeing a single pixel.
So the interface is disappearing because the humans aren't even invited to the party anymore.
It's a telling detail, and that creates a massive strategic pivot for the companies left standing. As Ben Thompson noted in Straitakery, application layer companies can't just rely on being a pretty wrapper for OpenAI or Anthropic. They have to build swappable architectures and capture data liquidity. They need to create a flywheel where the more your personal data flows through their specific agent, the more indispensable that agent becomes. It's about moving from a tool you use to an intermediary that negotiates for you.
I love the idea of an agent negotiating a disputed hotel charge or a tense email with a landlord. But there's a dark side to having an intermediary that diffuses tension by focusing only on objective facts. If my agent is scrubbing the emotional friction out of my professional interactions, am I actually communicating, or am I just two algorithms trading JSON files?
That is the risk. We're seeing a new category of companion AI emerge that intentionally embraces human-like traits, personality, opinion, and even probabilistic disagreement. These aren't just utility bots, they are designed to feel real. But the big players, the Apples and Googles of the world, might actually be structurally unable to ship these. They have too much brand safety to risk a global assistant having a sassy opinion or an irrational argument with a user. This leaves a massive opening for smaller, more unhinged players to capture the emotional layer of the market.
Unhinged is a terrifying way to describe the next generation of our primary social interfaces.
It gets more complex when you look at the infrastructure. There is a growing concern that the political neutrality of these models is an illusion. Because models are subject to secret weights and the specific incentives of their founders, there is a risk that the culture we consume is being subtly engineered by the political donors who fund the frontier labs.
So we aren't just being nudged by algorithms, we're being nudged by the hidden political architecture of our personal assistants.
And it's not just about social engineering, it's about the physical reality of how we use these tools. Hard Fork recently analyzed this, suggesting that AI-driven companionship isn't a replacement for humans, but a technological prosthesis. It only becomes a functional substitute when the underlying social infrastructure, our actual communities and families, has already collapsed. It's a reactive technology, not a proactive replacement for human connection.
Which brings us back to the business of it all. If these agents are the new gatekeepers, how does a brand even reach a human anymore?
They can't just rely on the old ways. As Masters of Scale pointed out, the traditional Google search model, where you pay for a top link, is being disrupted. To survive, marketplaces have to move toward a content as authority model. They need to use influencers and educational content to create artifacts that an AI agent can find and trust. We're moving into the era of generative engine optimization, or GEO. The goal isn't just to rank in a list, it's to ensure that when an agent is solving a problem, it is incentivized to refer the user to your specific service.
So the new marketing department is just a team of SEO specialists writing for bots.
It's even more targeted than that. Look at Patreon's strategy. According to Decoder with Nilay Patel, they aren't trying to build an AI company that generates art. They are targeting the outer rings of a creator's business. They want administrative AI to handle the boring stuff, tax management, email flows, marking chapters. They are automating the low-value tasks that drain a creator's energy, leaving the creative core untouched. That is the blueprint for the next wave. Find the friction in the periphery and automate it.
Even if the tech is brilliant, the regulatory landscape is looking like a fortress.
It might be a deliberate one. There's a theory on all in that the push for an FAA for AI, the kind of heavy-duty government oversight and approval processes we see in aviation, is a calculated move by companies like Anthropic. By lobbying for high-level regulation, they create massive moats. It's much easier for a giant with a legal department to navigate a complex regulatory landscape than it is for a garage startup to meet those safety standards. It effectively uses the law to protect their proprietary models from being disrupted by open-source advancements.
App developers need to start designing for the inspectors and the agents as much as the end user.
The logic of the interface is changing.
Investors should look for companies building deep, private data moats rather than those just building better chat interfaces. Keep an eye on the first major disagreement between a high-profile user and a commercial agent. How the fallout is handled will tell us if we're moving toward partnership or pure automation. But as these agents start navigating our private lives, the question of how they protect our borders becomes much more physical. We used to think the digital battlefield was about breaching a firewall, stealing a database, and vanishing. Now it feels like the battlefield is just everything. The walls aren't just being climbed, they're being bypassed by things we didn't even know were part of the perimeter.
That's because the perimeter has fundamentally migrated from the network boundary to the much more porous layer of SaaS-to-SaaS integrations. We're seeing a shift from breaking in to logging in, where attackers exploit powerful, non-expiring OAuth tokens to move laterally through cloud ecosystems without ever triggering a traditional intrusion alert.
The perimeter is now just a collection of allow buttons we clicked 6 months ago and forgot about.
The Clue Salesforce breach is the perfect case study. By compromising a single integration service credential, attackers could programmatically extract massive volumes of CRM data via APIs. It's not about cracking a password, it's about hijacking a pre-authorized trust relationship.
It's almost poetic. We've spent decades building fortresses, only to leave the side doors unlocked because we wanted our calendar to sync with our project management tool.
And the automation is making that unlocked door much easier to find. As the A16Z show noted, AI-driven cybersecurity creates a symmetrical escalatory ladder. The same capability used by white hat defenders to find bugs is functionally identical to the engine used for exploitation. We're seeing the rise of vibe coding, where developers use AI agents to pull in dependencies based on how right the code feels, rather than verifying the underlying math. This enables massive-scale typosquatting and prompt injection, where an LLM might be tricked into trusting a malicious package simply because its readme file uses high-quality, authoritative-sounding language.
I love that. I trust this code because the documentation has great vibes. It's the death of due diligence via the democratization of good enough.
It's actually much more systemic than just bad vibes. CyberWire Daily highlighted a massive vulnerability class called Cordyceps, where insecure GitHub Actions configurations and CI/CD workflows allow even free-tier users to hijack build pipelines. This creates a direct pipeline from a minor configuration error to a compromised software supply chain. When you layer on the fact that North Korean groups like Sapphire Sleet are now actively targeting NPM packages, you see a chain where a single hijacked build process can infect thousands of downstream applications.
It's like a digital contagion. One bad apple in the library, and suddenly your entire operating system is compromised.
And the targets are getting more physical. We're seeing a shift in operational technology, or OT, threats. There is a growing gap between the intent and the capability we see in the wild. Some recent malware like Xion Siphon uses very overt, almost amateurish naming conventions. This suggests we might be seeing non-functional prototypes, experimental codebases that are being tested in the wild before they are refined into actual weapons. We are already seeing malware specifically targeting chlorine dosing and reverse osmosis in water infrastructure.
The goal isn't just to crash a server, it's to physically alter the chemistry of our water supply.
Or to manipulate our psychology. CyberWire Daily reported on a strategic shift towards cyberpsychological operations, where groups like Iran link muddy water use OT, like triggering emergency sirens, not to cause physical destruction but to erode public trust in institutions. They even use ransomware-style tactics on Microsoft Teams as a smokescreen. They launch a fake extortion demand to occupy the security team, while their primary intelligence collection happens silently in the background.
I sometimes wonder if the people designing these attack vectors are actually more interested in the chaos than the actual theft. It's less Ocean's 11 and more total anarchy.
The chaos is the point of the infrastructure. And looking further ahead, we have a massive looming deadline, the quantum threat. The US government has set an aggressive timeline for post-quantum cryptography modernization by 2030 and 2031. This is a race against Q-Day, the moment a quantum computer can break our current encryption standards. Some experts like Ellen Boehm predict this could arrive as early as 2029.
Which is particularly stressful given that the US is simultaneously committing to building its own functional quantum computer by 2028. That is a very tight window for a software migration.
It is a logical paradox. But the difficulty isn't just the math, it's the scale. The transition to quantum-resistant standards is a forever activity, not a one-time patch. You have to move toward a model where all cryptographic assets can be dynamically swapped as the math evolves. If you don't, you're left vulnerable to harvest now, decrypt later attacks, where adversaries steal encrypted data today, waiting for the hardware to catch up.
Security architects need to start auditing every single cryptographic asset in their high-revenue applications immediately.
Keep an eye on the integration logs for unexpected OAuth token usage. That's the first sign the perimeter has already moved.
But if the very tools we use to build software are now the primary way we break it, we have to wonder, how much more hardware can the global economy actually sustain before the energy costs of running all this AI-driven security and the attacks themselves start to break the bank? I was looking at my receipt for a new MacBook Pro yesterday, and I couldn't help but wonder if I'm actually paying for a laptop or just subsidizing a data center in Virginia.
Well, you're likely paying for both, because we are officially in the middle of the great AI compute crunch. It's not just about running out of GPUs. We're seeing a structural cannibalization of the entire semiconductor supply chain.
The AI-flation everyone is whispering about is just a fancy way of saying my computer is getting more expensive because someone else wants to train a chatbot.
There's a signal here, as the All-In crew recently pointed out, while seeing a literal prisoner's dilemma in the supply chain. The price-insensitive demand for high-bandwidth memory, or HBM, in massive data centers is sucking up all the available DRAM, which forces manufacturers to divert capacity away from consumer electronics. This creates a direct arrow from data center expansion to higher production costs for Apple's Mac Studio and iPad lines.
It's a lovely little cycle of misery. But is it just a shortage of parts, or is the physical world actually running out of places to plug these things in?
It's both. We've moved past the era of just needing more chips and into an era of real estate speed. The bottleneck has shifted from chip availability to the physical ability to deploy power and cooling. You can have all the H100s in the world, but if you can't secure a permit or a power grid connection, they're just expensive paperweights.
Which explains why I keep seeing headlines about megapods and shipping containers. Are we just going to start stacking GPUs in parking lots?
That is precisely the strategy. There's a huge push toward modular, prefabricated hardware, essentially compute kitchens or shipping containers that can be deployed on concrete pads with a 90-day build cycle. There's even a massive hint in a recent trademark filing from June 18th that Tesla might be looking to integrate these modular AI units into existing supercharger stations, leveraging their pre-approved land and existing power infrastructure.
The future of AI is just a very expensive, very hot version of a Tesla rest stop.
If you can't find land on Earth, you might look to the stars. Some analysts are predicting a shift toward orbital compute. The logic is that while terrestrial data centers face massive regulatory and zoning hurdles, reusable Starship launches could eventually reduce the cost of deploying a gigawatt of compute to $5 billion, compared to the $60 billion required for a terrestrial equivalent.
I'm sure the neighbors in Ohio will be thrilled to find out a satellite is beaming transformer-level heat directly onto their cornfields.
It's a massive gamble, and the industry is splitting. You have people like Elon Musk pursuing orbital infrastructure, while others, like SoftBank's Masayoshi Son, are explicitly rejecting space-based computing as a losing bet, preferring to double down on massive terrestrial capacity.
And I assume this isn't just about the hardware, but the actual math of the bills being paid.
The capital expenditure is staggering. Bloomberg Tech noted that we're seeing a hidden convergence in corporate finance, where the Mount Rushmore of tech, Microsoft, Amazon, and Alphabet, are essentially operating as free cash flow negative entities. They are burning massive amounts of cash on infrastructure, necessitating huge debt and equity raises that look more like the early days of SpaceX than a mature software company.
So the giants are essentially just very large, very expensive construction companies now.
And the supply lag is real. Olin highlighted that the impact of massive deals, like that OpenAI contract from last December, doesn't show up instantly. There's a rigid multi-month lag, 4 months for wafer production, 2 months for server assembly, and another month just for power energization. You can't just flip a switch.
It sounds like the only way to survive the bottleneck is to stop trying to build the perfect chip and just start scavenging the old ones.
That's the disaggregated inference trend. You're seeing a move toward using specialized chips, like Grok or Cerebras wafer-scale architecture, to handle the memory-intensive parts of a model, which can actually extend the useful life of older GPUs like the H100. Even the software side is shifting. Companies are using the public cloud for rapid prototyping, but moving stable, high-volume workloads to private, GPU-heavy environments to manage costs.
It's a chaotic scramble for every watt of power and every megabyte of memory.
It is.
But the long-term view from Bloomberg Tech is that while we're facing an interim period of higher inflation due to this massive infrastructure rewiring, the end goal is a highly productive, deflationary era of growth by the early 2030s.
Investors need to stop looking at who has the best model and start looking at who owns the transformer. Keep an eye on the next round of quarterly earnings from Micron to see if the memory supply tightness finally breaks the consumer electronics market. But if the terrestrial grid is hitting a wall, we might have to start looking at the much more expensive problem of how much we're willing to pay to move the entire internet into orbit. Alex, if I tried to pay for a coffee by paying a 7,000% markup just to prove the milk was space grade, I'd be arrested. So why is the space economy currently treating a $7 connector like a piece of fine jewelry?
Because that's the reality of the hardware inflation we're seeing in orbit. According to CyberWire Daily, the economic disparity is extreme. Specialized post-processing for vacuum and radiation survival drives that $7 component up to
$529. That's not a supply chain, that's a ransom.
It's part of a massive infrastructure lag. We've seen a tenfold increase in orbital objects since 2019, but we're trying to support 2026 demand using manufacturing facilities that are, on average, 26 years old.
So we're essentially trying to run a hypermodern sci-fi movie using props from a community theater production of Apollo 13.
So here's the picture. The pressure is mounting from terrestrial sectors too. Doug Anderson of PwC noted that competition from AI data centers is driving up lead times for critical electrical infrastructure, like transformers, to over 130 weeks.
It's a bottleneck sandwich. We have more satellites than ever, but the factory to build them is a relic.
And it's getting harder to find suppliers. CyberWire Daily highlighted a profitability trap where high qualification burdens drive players away. One supplier actually exited the pressure vessel market because the engineering overhead consumed 30% of their staff time for only single-digit revenue.
So if we can't afford the perfect parts, do we just start launching junk?
That might be the only way to scale. We might see a fundamental shift from high reliability to high-risk engineering, utilizing more commercial off-the-shelf technology like silicon-based solar panels to meet mass proliferation requirements.
Satellite constellation investors need to stop modeling for bespoke luxury and start budgeting for mass-produced reliability. Watch for the next SpaceX bond rating update to see if the market continues to value Starlink's recurring revenue over the sheer intensity of their cash burn. As we wrap up this edition, the common thread through everything we've discussed today, from the rise of vibe coding to the race for orbital compute, is the decoupling of capability from understanding. We are entering a period where the ability to generate complex outputs, whether it is a functioning software module or a massive neural network, is outstripping our capacity to verify, maintain, or even power them. We are building a high-speed, automated superstructure on top of a physical and digital foundation that is increasingly strained, brittle, and expensive.
The implication runs deeper. The single most critical implication here isn't just that things are getting harder, but that the fundamental unit of risk for CTOs and infrastructure architects has shifted. It is no longer about managing the failure of a single component, but managing the downstream consequences of automated, unverified complexity. For the decision makers at firms like OpenAI, AWS, or even the heavy industry players managing the electrical grid, the primary burden is no longer preventing errors during creation, but preventing the systemic collapse that occurs when high-velocity automated systems like the Cordyceps vulnerability or automated SaaS integrations interact in ways that no human architect actually understands. The cost of innovation is no longer just capital, it is the mounting interest on a massive, automated technical debt.
It's the transition from being builders to being curators of an increasingly volatile ecosystem.
The data tells a story, so if you want to know if this era of unverified, high-velocity scaling is hitting a hard limit, watch the 2028 US quantum computing milestones. If we see the first meaningful breakthroughs in decryption that bypass the post-quantum standards being implemented today, it will confirm that our rush toward automated, good enough security has finally outpaced our ability to defend the perimeter.
Thanks for joining us on this technology edition. We'll see you next Monday.